prepare yourself, for in this post-apocalyptic hellhole, there is nothing but conflict, nothing but opposition, nothing but carnage. The Mad King has assembled his army of millions and has waged his campaign against the mysterious, faceless, nameless, alien Dentsu megacorporation. Who will reign supreme in this struggle and break the back of the loser across the shards of a once great symbol, now a skeleton of what it once was, a glorious creation? You must choose a side, because there will be no bystanders, only combatants and casualties. Who will win the War of Woodstock, and which side will you be on, the winner or the loser? Pick your side on this episode of the Punk News Podcast, episode 444.
I can truly say I don't give a fuck about your money, because it means so much to you and all of your money. Why does it mean so much to you? You cite the land of greed, and I'm talking about a world of need. Money has nothing to do with the value of life.
The war for Woodstock ravages forward. Adam White, are you prepared for the oncoming war, the oncoming epic, the oncoming destruction and melee? Are you ready for battle?
I'm so delighted by the amount of personal interest that you have taken in this debacle.
We'll talk about it later in the show, but I'm really enjoying it because I really have no horse in this race. I'm just enjoying the conflict and the chaos and the personalities involved. We'll talk about it more later on in the podcast. Tom Trauma, have you picked a side, or will you choose which badge, which flag you will fly on this episode?
I really haven't, but I do always enjoy it when your intros get super epic. I mean, occasionally my mind starts to wander, but for some reason I enjoy those epic intros. I wonder if our listeners enjoy it as much as I do.
I do love that we have a very cyberpunk kind of conflict here, that we've got like a wild rebel madman, you know, with his band of, you know, revolutionaries fighting against a nameless megacorp, which is basically every single cyberpunk.
I'm pretty sure they're both faceless megacorps, but you can call the one guy rough shabble if you want.
Well, welcome to the Punk News Podcast. You can always reach at podcast@punknews.org. We're not going to do mail this week because I'm going to talk about a show that I threw this past week quickly. This past week, I threw the Dogs, legendary proto-punk band from Detroit. The opener was Joel Tannenbaum of Pie United. He's got a new band. The new band is called Code of the Jaguar. And if you apply United, I was actually really surprised. The recordings are somewhat, I would say, not laid back, but somewhat...
I'd say they're aggressive for the era.
Code of the Jaguar? No, not the Dogs, Code of the Jaguar.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll go there.
Joel Tannenbaum, new band. It's nuanced and not calm, but what's the word when something has like a lot of different textures to it? I can't even think
nuanced.
Of it.
Nuanced?
Multifaceted.
Yeah, like not explosive. The recordings are not explosive. However, live, Joel, who was actually not the front man for Plow United, he's the front man for the new band, and actually live, it like really was punky and explosive, and honestly, it was really cool, and the crowd dug it. After them, a band that I don't know a whole lot about, they came down with the Dogs, the Atlantic Thrills played, and then you kind of garage rock, and they were really good. People dug it. Honestly, like, there's a lot of garage rock bands out there, but they were like really good garage rock, kind of more of the, I would say, psychedelic, more kind of the late garage rock era than, say, the Nuggets era, which is a little bit more, you know, shorter and punkier. It was kind of more acid out, if you will. After that was Qualm, which is a band that we had at the Punk News Magnificent Matinee with World Inferno. Let me tell you, boys, can I pick them or can I pick them? Qualm was amazing. I mean, Qualm really was really, really good. When they, nobody knew who they were when they played, But then everybody fell, just like Crazy in the Brains. Like as soon as they were playing, everybody fell in love with them. And you can generally judge how much people really like a band by how much merch they sell after the show. No one knew who Quam was before they played. After they played, people were lining up to buy their stuff. They were explosive, punky, melodic, almost like No Doubt. If No Doubt was a little bit more punky during Tragic Kingdom era and less ska, they were phenomenal. They were great. After that, the Dogs played, and the Dogs were like awesome. I mean, the Dog, like Tom said, they were aggressive, and not like I mean, they're older, let's be real, they're like 65 or something, and they just like kicked ass. They played 11 songs, they smashed them super quick, hard, fast, and it was awesome. So that was the punk news. What did I call that one? Oh, the Proto Punk Party. And honestly, listen, people,
it's not a John Gentile show unless it has excessive alliteration.
Well, that's my deal. That's how I separate my. And I, well, actually, two couple of things we'll talk about in 1 second.
Did you get a good crowd? How was the crowd? Did you get a good crowd?
That crowd was pretty good. It wasn't sold out. It really should have been sold out because the Dogs were amazing. There's just so many shows in Philadelphia. I mean, Philadelphia has the, I guess, nice problem in that night when I booked the show, I was the only punk show in town. Actually, there was one other one, and it was unfortunate that there was four punk shows. Four like house level punk shows, not even like bars or concerts. You know what I mean? Like there's a crazy number of punk shows in Philadelphia right now. Too much, but I guess it's a good thing. You know what I mean? But I mean the Dogs were amazing. And honestly, if you can see like these, like if a promoter really is saying something like a special event, and you were even semi into it, you should probably check it out because it really was an awesome show. And I don't think the Dogs are gonna come back to Philadelphia or even the East Coast. I mean, listen, they're not making a lot of money doing this, you know what I mean? And they're just there for the joy of it all, and they were thrilled, and they were having fun, and they were awesome. So one thing I do want to mention, actually, not to make this show all about me, we'll make this section about me, then I'll phase out during the discussion section of the news. So Tom, I don't know if you, in previous episodes of the podcast, I said I was annoyed that another promoter was copying my bills, you know, essentially. And actually, a different promoter copied another one of my bills. I wish this, as you guys both, because at this point, it's almost kind of a compliment. You know what I mean? However, Tom, did you see the poster that I posted that I said, is that influenced by the poster that I made?
Yeah, that was like just in our private group, right?
Right. So it
had a similar shape to it, you know, the way things were laid out. It's hard to say.
Adam, am I going insane? Am I becoming paranoid and obsessive?
You think John may be taking too much credit for the birth of punk rock at this point, Adam?
At first, I thought this because I didn't pick up the similarity was more so in the art on the poster in connection with one of the artists there than the full bill. So I was looking at your bill, and I was looking at this poster, and I was looking at the bill, and I just thought to myself, like, John is... John's losing it. John's lost it. I don't understand. I understand the connection here. John's paranoid, but no, it is pretty similar in that respect.
Is it, or is John just browbeating you into agreeing with him?
Well, I mean,
well, a little A, a little B.
You know,
I Finger came out and another album by some metal band that had a very similar theme to it. You know, it's these things happen. Is it subconscious? Is it intentional? Well,
but see, with this guy, it might not be subconscious because he in the past, like you know, our punk news shows are relatively unique. It's never just four hardcore bands. It's never just four pop. It's different bands. The prime example: Scissor Crack and Jack Talcum. That doesn't but before I did that show, like no one thought to make that pairing, but that pairing actually like was a perfect pairing. And little did I know, Joe Jack Talcum is like his favorite artist, along with They Might Be Giants and one other band. I forget which. A Weird Al Yankovic. You know what I mean? And so that bill.
Those are his favorite artists.
Yeah. So that bill was copied wholesale, right? And then the poster got copied for a different show. You know, I don't know. I'm not looking to beef. You know, I could be wrong. And I should be complimented. It's just annoyed. I guess it's just annoyed that, you know, I'm the little guy here and a more established guy is taking what I'm doing and making more money off of
it. I'd say that's always the way. If you find something that works, somebody with better financing is going to steal it from you. But as far as the art goes, was that something you developed or did someone do that for you?
No, the whole – the show is called the idea is the Summer Chimera. It's three acts and three unique acts and three powerful acts.
Yeah, it so definitely I call it had a strong triangle presence.
Right. But it's a three-headed beast. You know what I mean?
Oh, and, that's okay.
And the whole reason this whole I just had the idea of having a chimera, and then the show developed from there. You know, like I would do a chimera.
John, you're a three-headed beast right now, and all three of your heads are pissed off.
I know. And then the other poster had a three-headed beast on their poster of a similar act. You know, I'm like, man, I could be wrong though. Doing copyright law, coincidences definitely do happen in copyright, you know. But then again, over a span of time, multiple times, I don't know. I don't own the concept of chimeras. You know, the Greeks do. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Well, you got three choices.
Wage war.
This is the way you always do. You always do Adam and I questions. You give us like seven choices. We're supposed to pick one. Now you have three choices. You can ignore it, or A. B, you can sue him. You being a lawyer, you should know whether or not you have a good case. Or C, you could like just go piss on his car door handles or something and do some random like violence, which that could be fun too. That would be that'd be the most punk rock way to go. Just pee on his door handles. And when he opens his door, he has to touch your pee.
I think I'm just going to have to ignore it because I'm not in the legal right. You know what I mean? And it's so easy for his Counter-Strike to be like, this guy thinks he owns bands. He doesn't own bands. You know what I mean? It's easy to make me look like a dick, you know? So
damn it, John. I wanted to come meet up with you and pee on some door handles.
We can do that.
I don't see what was stopping any of you from executing on that plan.
Well, look at this one. June 1, Stizzicrack, back by Crazy in the Brains. Dan Britt Nobicon of Chumbawamba. First East Coast show in like 9 years or 8 years. And Crazy in the Brains doing a solo set, and Roadkiller, Australian thrash metal. June 1, Philadelphia, Creep Records, only 13 smackers. Be there. It's going to be awesome.
Is Roadkiller a full band, or has she played a track, or what?
Right. It's either going to be Roadkiller, essentially a young lady named Zibidi Tank.
Yeah.
She was in a band called Drop Tank, and she was also in a band called Motor Babe. The recordings, I believe, are all her. Live, it's her and a drummer, and I think she might add a bassist to the band. But it's cool. It's kind of like halfway between Celtic Frost and Slayer, and she just
heavy stuff, a little Motorhead maybe.
Yeah, exactly. And she just rips, so it'll be cool.
Cool.
That's what's happening, boys. What's happening with you guys?
Nothing.
John, we're just working our boring jobs and living our boring lives and not doing all this fantastic, podcast worthy shit to talk about that you seem to be doing. So I don't know. I don't know what to add for this.
I was like 2 minutes late because I had to go make this really awful drink of like whiskey and LaCroix, essentially. So that's what I'm up to. I'm up to about a quarter of the way through the glass.
All right. Well, I'm going to play a track by a band called Surfboard. Have you guys heard of Surfboard? And we're going to talk about them later on the show, but
I have not.
Yeah, Surfboard is one of these bands that like I've seen the name around, but like I never checked them out. Like it's a band like you see in an article somewhere, but you never even like think about. You know, Surfboard is actually like freaking fantastic. I even have a record that I've got a split with. It's the Dwarves and Surfboard, and I never even listened to the Surfboard side, and they're like really good. Surfboard is a young lady and three old first wave, well, maybe not first wave, but like 80s punk dudes. So it's this young lady and like three old dudes, and they just kick out like pretty unique. Well, it's old school influence, hardcore slash punk, but it's definitely got kind of the 2019 vibe to it. You know, it's a young lady. She's not taking shit from everybody. She's going to do what she wants to do. And the music is great. The lyrics are great. The vocals are great. And it's one of these mysterious bands that might be attached to a major label, because her current label is Noel Gallagher of the guy from the Shins or the Hives or one of those bands, one of those
bands.
The Strokes, that's it, the Strokes.
Oh, there is.
She's on the label of the guy from the Strokes, which so that might be a sub-major label. So it's one of these weird things that we've seen this a lot about 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, and we're seeing again now with like the Regrets, with the Chats, and maybe with this band, possibly Amel and the Sniffers. We're seeing like very underground around and very punk bands that aren't necessarily political, but are kind of wild. Actually, that's exactly them. They're not that political. Well, they're political in the personal context, not in the social, not in the national context. But, you know, they're like wild, they're crazy. They're usually young, they're usually good looking people. And there's something, you know, why is their website so good? Why is their promotion so good? Why is their tour booking so good? And you say, well, am I just being a crazy person, or is there something behind it? This is one of those bands. But despite that all, it's the music that counts, and this music is awesome. So this is a track by Surfboard. I don't know what song I'm going to play, but this is Surfboard. They got a new album out. It's real good. John Conspiracy Podcast, and we're going to talk about some more conspiracies. The war for Woodstock. Who will win? I'm just going to start at the beginning and work towards the end, and let you guys reply. So, as you guys know, Woodstock 50. It was supposed to be this August, mid-August. It was being thrown by one of the guys who was a member of the original Woodstock founders. However, last month they started to have problems. The Black Lips pulled out. Then it turned out that they didn't have the permits yet, and they had just filed for the permits. Like two or three weeks ago, which is crazy, because usually these kind of guys apply for permits a year or even 2 years in advance. For example, Lollapalooza, they file for permits like two to three years in advance. Coachella is like 2 to 3 years in advance for the permits, you know. And these guys are filing them like 4 months in advance. Plus, tickets weren't even for sale, and rumors were the tickets were going to be $150. Plus, they were selling a lot of cheesy things like a psychedelic tube for $18. Plus, the line like. A lot of people were annoyed at the presentation. It was, quote, Woodstock 50, but the lineup was just any other generic big music festival. Then they got bigger problems. The lead investor, which was a company called Dentsu, pulled out, and Dentsu said the event was canceled, which was kind of weird. It's like, well, why is the investor saying that the event is canceled? Do they have the power to do that? And, of course, Woodstock 50 shot back, and they said, it's not canceled. What's still going on? Dentsu's lying. We just have to find a new investor. Then after that, the production arm, Superfly, pulled out, which basically left Woodstock as nothing. I mean, it's a nothing. Without the investment arm and without the production arm, it's a name only. So just last night, actually, so 2 days ago when you're listening to this, Woodstock 50 filed suit against Dentsu for pulling out their $17 million investment. And Woodstock said they didn't have the right to pull out the money because we need to use it for the festival, and the festival is still going to take place. Dentsu said, yes, we did have the right to pull it out. It's our money to put in, and now we're pulling it out. And then actually Woodstock also asked for what's called a temporary restraining Temporary restraining order is the most mild and quickest form of injunction you can get. They basically said, don't let Dentsu say anything bad about us to the media, at least until we can have a hearing for a preliminary injunction. And so the court granted that just today, but that's not uncommon. It's very common for a temporary restraining order to be granted because they only last like a week, 3 days, 4 days, and they'll have the hearing for the temporary preliminary injunction next week. And so that's when it'll really get decided on whether or not Dentsu's got a problem or not. And so the point is, and Woodstock, meanwhile, is still saying, it's still happening, but you get the idea. It's just some guy in a room saying, he's got to believe. You know. Oh, and meanwhile, interestingly enough, Woodstock's attorney is an attorney that represented Donald Trump during his whole fiasco from last year. So that's very Woodstock and Summer of Love-ish, if you will. Anyways, so the whole thing's a mess. I think it's a very interesting conflict. And then it's this semi-crazy guy who was a hippie, but now he's like backed by millions of dollars, and he's fighting against this gigantic Japanese conglomeration investment company that has no face, that has no real representative. And it's a real battle going on. And also, interestingly, I'll just add this, the Japanese culture is generally very reluctant to sue. Japan has among the lowest civil litigation and lowest criminal suits in the entire world. And so you could say it's very American for Woodstock LC to file a lawsuit right away. I don't know if Japanese companies are used to that or not. I mean, Japanese citizens tend not to sue, but I don't know if that's true with Japanese giant corporations, especially when they're international like Dentsu. But this is just a crazy story, boys. Did anyone see this coming?
Not this, no. I figured they'd have it together a little better than this.
Yeah.
I mean, the only spirit of the original Woodstock is the fact that they don't have their shit together, if we're being honest. That's the only way it's really like the one 50 years ago.
Which, I mean, you could tilt your head and look at it from an angle and say like, oh, well, that's part of the charm is that it's not very corporate. It's all being held together by the passion. Yeah. Not very man. Corporate.
Yeah.
But,
That's why it's only $450 to get in, because of its lack of being corporate.
Before fees.
Yeah.
One of the big problems, but like among the problems that they are creating for themselves here, of which I guess there's many, is the audience for something like this that is going to go see a bunch of either middle of the road radio friendly acts backed by a smattering of like classic rock revival groups and things like that. Including, by the way, John, it's the Black Keys, not the Black Lips. The Black Lips ain't doing this shit.
Oh yeah, you're right.
I was hoping it was the Black Crows.
That Black Crows probably would make more sense. But the kind of person that was going to go to this, and that was going to really be turned on by the Woodstock brand and celebrating like 50 years of that, they're boomers, right? And to me,
they're at the older edge of the
right, boomers, right? They're old boomers. And if you had to pick one group of consumers that's going to be skittish about plunking down their money for something that doesn't, that has some risk inherent in it. I can imagine like these like aging boomers are going to be like the last ones who would want to do that. Like these are the kind of people that are scared to make an online purchase because they don't want to put their credit card on the internet. And you're going to be like, no.
You're speaking too much truth. Right.
Like pay $450 to come to this event, which is now just riddled in public, you know, backbiting and controversy and things like that,
and sleep in a tent.
Yeah, and then not to mention that, right? So I that is not the group of consumers that you are going to entice by making the whole thing seem like an unorganized shit show. And I mean, hey, I'm all for unorganized shit show. I was the one advocating that I myself go to some dirty psych rock live out of my car festival a couple weeks ago on the show.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you were talking about, yeah, just walking around on magic mushrooms and washing yourself out of the porta potty.
Right. Right. But I feel like I can do that. Whereas my, you know, my.
Do you feel like you could do it, or do you feel like you have to prove it to yourself that you can still do it?
No, I could do it, but like my 65-year-old aunt would not do that, and would not, you know, would not plunk down any money that I could imagine where there's like the slightest hint that the thing is gonna go south on him.
And the fact of the matter is, your 65-year-old aunt would be cool with seeing Crosby, Stills, and Nash or whatever the old time acts are, but she's like, does she care about Beyonce or whatever the newer acts are?
Well, no, that's a whole other angle.
Everything to everyone. How do you be everything to everyone? Anyway, yeah, I'm sorry.
No, but that's absolutely like that's like a legitimate problem with this festival lineup. Just from the, you know, if everything was going perfectly, and you know, and there were no problems, it was all just going to go off without a hitch. You know, a stage wasn't going to fall on anyone. Everything was going to be great. You would still have to answer that question by which, like, you know, is the crowd that is going to go see these Coachella bands the same as the crowd that's going to want to go see, God, I don't know, what was one of the old bands? What was one of the revival bands that was on this?
I think Country Joe McDonald, Hot Tuna.
Oh, he's got to be 90 years old. He was old at Woodstock.
But
you
right.
know, it's fun. A couple years ago, didn't the guy who does Coachella, or the main guy from Coachella, didn't they have like a dream Coachella, but it was like $1,000 or $1,500 or something, but they had like Paul McCartney and the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, they did. It was, I forget what it was called. It was called Desert Trip.
Neil Young, Rolling Stones, Paul McCartney, Roger Waters, Bob Dylan, and I think one other person.
Right. Yeah, that was the dream geezer lineup for the people who really want to spend some bucks.
Yeah. And like, I don't know how successful that was, but I assume it was very successful, but it also was thrown by someone that has thrown these big events repeatedly without major incident. This whole thing is just, there comes a point where like, I don't know what they gain by swiping at each other in public, because I don't understand what that helps. If there was a significant investment of like, say, like public love towards the idea of a Woodstock 50, then I could see there being like some amount of rallying around the promoter here to make the thing happen. And I'm trying to think of like what's the closest like punk rock festival equivalent to that, and I don't know. Let's say you were die hard
Fest or
but let's say you're like a die hard Warped Tour person, and then you learned that the Warped Tour was in trouble because Capital One was gonna freeze Kevin Lyman's accounts or something like that.
I've been to the last two Warped Tours. They should be in trouble.
Well, but no, but you know what I mean? Like, let's say that was your shit. Like, you love the Warped Tour, and all of a sudden the Warped Tour was in trouble because of some investment bullshit. You would probably not read too much into the investment bullshit, even if it was Warped Tour's fault, and be on their side. Warped
Tour hasn't been off for 25 years, and it, you know, it didn't start 50 years ago, and it didn't do its last one, you know, 20 years ago. I get what you're going for. Right?
Like, there's no brand investment, right? Like, if you have that,
like maybe Lollapalooza would be a better one.
Lollapalooza might be a better one, or even like just take it out of a festival,
because that's always in Chicago now.
And just like put it into a record label standpoint. Let's say you love the kind of stuff that Fat Records puts out, but then all of a sudden it got into the news that like Fat Mike was fighting with the bank. You're not going to take the bank side, even if Fat Mike isn't doing his books right. Right? You know.
his new ex-wife owns half of Fat Mike.
Right. So like, Woodstock is a non-brand. It's not a thing that
the kids. It's not, at least. Yeah.
Well, no, I don't even know if it is for old people. The problem with it is that culture moves in this lapsed 20-year nostalgia cycle, where I mean, 20 might not be the exact number that makes sense, but all of a sudden the things that were popular when you were a kid, all of a sudden creep back around when you're sort of in your prime and have all the money, and both you're nostalgic for that stuff and people realize that they can market to you, right? So it happened in the 70s when, you know, all this stuff from the 50s started to come back in. So you had like shows like Happy Days being made that were like nostalgic about the '50s because, you know,
Happy Days was great, Adam. Don't ever talk bad.
I'm not speaking bad about it. I'm just saying that it fits that sort of like 20-year thing. And then you look at like,
right. Yeah, no, I agree. And then in the '90s, people said we're wearing bell bottoms in the early '90s.
Yeah. Like, right.
So you're right.
And then in the '90s, you had that '60s stuff and it made total sense.
Nostalgia was the one that was my generation's thing. And right now, if you, there's like this, these '80s throwback bands that play '80s covers and they will sell out venues that major metal bands could only dream of selling.
Well, not even that. You look at even what's going on in like the, not just in the nostalgia circuit, but in say, in what's happening in like underground rock. And it's just like, there's, I saw a band two nights ago where they had like six vintage analog synths stacked on top of each other on a stage. That was part of the act. And it was all like just a wash in this like 80s synth pop sound. And that's just, that is just the thing now that bands are doing. The guys from fucking Crusades, the punk band out of Ottawa that like sings about heretics and the devil and medieval.
Sings about medieval times. Yeah.
Medieval times and stuff like that. That band broke up recently. The two guys from that band have a new act called Surrender. And Surrender is the most like bright and shimmering 80s synth pop thing that you could think of. And it's not that they're chasing the synth pop dollar. It's just that like, it just fits that that's the thing.
Mighty synth pop dollar.
Right. Like that's the thing that those guys have some nostalgia from when they were kids and they, you know, now they're musicians, they can bring it back around. So if you look at that cycle, it totally made sense to, you know, to revive the Woodstock name in the '90s.
See, but they, you know, but they kind of did, right?
They did, right?
But the irony of the situation, Adam, is you're right about that, and I get that. I see people trying to sell me '80s shit all the time because that's my generation, right? But the thing is, with that '94 Woodstock and the '99 Woodstock, it was strictly for young people, right? I mean, there was nostalgia.
It was botched execution.
It was like Green Day and freaking. You guys still there?
Yeah. It was Limp Bizkit and all that shit for
especially. My screen went black and I, but yeah, it was.
I think Tom has fell down the hole.
Yeah. I can hear you. I think Tom's gone. Let's see.
All right.
I still see.
We'll wait and see if Tom crops back up, but yeah, Tom is absolutely right though. The lineups for the '90s Woodstocks were all screwy. And it was trying to cater more to that, to the people of that era. And that was an artistic failing. It was a failing in execution of them. But from a nostalgia standpoint, them going, oh, we should really hit on this brand because people are going to be into it.
I'm back, dudes. Can you guys hear me? No.
Hey, Tom's back.
Oh, I'm back. Okay.
All right. I was agreeing with
Don't ever speak ill of Limp Bizkit or I'll drive up there and. No, I'm just kidding. Speak as ill of them as you want.
No, but like you're right. The execution though of the '90s ones didn't make a lot of sense. But from a this is the thing that is going to be marketable for nostalgic reasons. Totally makes sense. But now,
but it drew a big crowd. Do you think it drew crowds and made money? I mean,
I don't think it was because of the name, right? Like the people that are going to show up and watch, you know, Green Day and Sheryl Crow and whoever else played with that Woodstock. '95 they were there for those bands.
Definitely 94 or 99, but yeah.
Was it 94?
Well, it was 69. The Woodstock 25 would have been 94.
94, 99, yeah. I thought it was Woodstock 95. I mean, anyways, doesn't matter.
Big 26th anniversary show.
Okay, 26 is a good number of years. But yeah, it made sense. Doesn't make sense now. So I don't know what they're banking on. Like the people.
Screw you, Woodstock. You're anti both sides.
Yeah. So now, John, I want to dig into your psychology here.
Sure.
Why are you gleefully covering this story? What is it about that? Like, I guess the question is like, where does your at whom is your Schadenfreude aimed? Are you delighted that something with the audacious branding of Woodstock 50 is a failure? Are you delighting in the fact that it's a failure given the lineup that was announced for it? do you just like seeing big money venture capitalists, you know, publicly play grab ass? Like, what is it here that you appreciate?
Well, I do like that last ad. Have you guys ever like dealt with people that are like venture capitalists?
No.
Dude, they are creeps. Like,
I was going to say, you should really get them into John Gentile Productions, dude. Imagine the shows you could throw.
They are such pains in the asses. I mean, they are crybaby. Well, that's a different story. Anyways, I think Woodstock is actually catching my ire. That really should be targeted against Ticketmaster and Live Nation. Everyone knows I am not down with Ticketmaster. I'm not down with Live Nation. I feel as though they are a monopoly, and I feel as though they are. I mean, with Ticketmaster, they're not even masking the fact that they're ripping you off now. They're making it clear. It's like, okay, you can buy this ticket as a resale ticket, so we can rip off people together. Like they're so blatant about how they're ripping people off. And you know, they have like, quote, meet and greet packages. They're like the deluxe premium meet and greet package. It's like, it's clear you're wasting money. And they're not even like hiding the fact that you're wasting money. They're just so blatant about it. And so I am extremely annoyed and fed up by the, I guess, what we call mainstream and large scale promotions and ticket sales construct, if you will. And I think the reason I'm mad at that is I actually kind of see that symbolic as the current, you know, growing divide and, you know, decline of the middle class, if you will. So that's really my ire. And so the reason Woodstock is catching that pain, if you will, is because it's so clearly just let's make a whole bunch of money. And I don't even really care about the original Woodstock that much. I mean, I like a lot of the bands that played. But like the original Woodstock was, it's not about the money, man. It's about peace and love. And let's just all come together as one and enjoy music, because that's what life's all about, man. And this is just such an obvious fraud that they're not even – it's a super expensive music festival with a bunch of bands that have nothing to do with each other. And we're just going to put the brand name Woodstock on it to sell you stuff. And they're not even like – it's almost refreshing at how crass they're being. They're like, we're not even going to try to make it look like it's actually Woodstock or anything like that. We're just going to say, we know you're stupid enough to pay a whole bunch of money just to see this brand that has nothing to do with what we're doing. And we're not even going to hide the fact that we think you're stupid, and we're just going to do it. And it almost worked, so I am enjoying watching it crash and burn. But I also do enjoy the fact that the guy that's running it really seems to be lost. And I also like the fact that his investor is like a mysterious Japanese megacorp, which is just weird and interesting and funny. Burn, baby, burn.
I'm so happy for you, John. Speaking of which, Black Flag... They're not playing Woodstock 50, but they could.
They should be.
I mean, give it
55. Maybe Woodstock 55 or Woodstock 60.
Woodstock 57. The Black Flag. All right. So Black Flag, they debuted a new lineup after not playing for about 4 years. So the band, of course, so it only includes, you know, original guitarist Svengali Greg Ginn. And this time out, so Mike Filali is returning on vocals. And so he sang for the band between, well, just on in 2013 and 2014. So this is my Mike Filali of, you know, skateboard fame. Tyler Smith, who played with the band in 2014, is back on bass.
He's the guy that replaced the Screeching Weasel guy who was on bass for about a hot minute.
Yeah. Their new drummer is Azaleas Gill, who is a session.
Alex Van Halen.
Yeah, session drummer. He's worked with Macy Gray, David Lee Roth, and the country band Charlie and the Regrets.
Wow!
So the
some pedigree.
The band's set list at the Sabroso event, it included tracks from Nervous Breakdown through Slip It In. But it did not include anything post that, I guess, in particular, any of the new stuff that they were trying to push. So Sabroso was a when did Sabroso go down exactly, or when is it?
There was actually three of them. I didn't even, there was three of them throughout the month in April. There was like one in Colorado. There was like two in L.A. and one somewhere else. It was like April 7, April 17, and one other date.
Right. Yeah. So Black Flag played the one that had the Offspring and Descendants and Face to Face playing it. So yeah. So John, you're always thrilled with what's going on with the convulsing corpse of Black Flag.
This is not Black.
Does this lineup strike you as any? I mean, is this just not a continuation of the Mike Flaley era?
That's exactly what it is. It's Greg Ginn and his new pal Mike Flaley and two guys that they have hanging around. You know what I mean? It's not Black Flag. It's Greg Ginn. And if it was just the Greg Ginn band, I'd say that's cool. I'll go see it. But it's not Black Flag. And as we've said before, Greg Ginn is a hypocrite. He really is. You know, he insulted all the other bands. You know, you didn't put out anything new. We're doing new stuff. You know, and then they go and they play they don't even play like the later era of Black Flag stuff, which Greg Ginn famously says is the best era of Black Flag, which is not. You know, they play all the old stuff. They reform when Flag reforms, coincidentally, you know, and it's Valeri just does not have the style or the character that any of the original four Black Flag singers had. And so, as I've said before, when Flag reformed, he could not see past his own hubris. And if he had sat back and said, I'm not in Flag, Flag is a fraud, you all know it's a fraud, come see the Greg Ginn Band. And I guarantee you, well, I don't guarantee you, but most people would have said, oh, yeah, Flag just kind of doing something old. You know, Greg Ginn, he's the real mastermind. But
High, dude. That would have never happened. You know that never would have happened.
No, I think it would have if he started at the beginning before.
I don't think so.
So
that Black Flag name has still got some weight behind it, dude. Band does not.
Greg Ginn had the ace, the trump, in that I'm not in Black Flag. Without me, it's not really Black Flag. It's the Dead Kennedys without Jello.
I mean, he has been saying that, but it's still...
No, but you got to let me finish. He has been saying that, but then he also launched his own Black Flag, which Ron Reyes was great, but not counting for Ron Reyes, was terrible. And the new songs that Greg Ginn wrote, they were obviously not intended for Black Flag. They were intended for a stupid Good For You band. And live, they were bad. They were even worse. I mean, with Ron Reyes, they are all right. With Mike Valeri, they were just bad. You know, no one – Greg Ginn has said time and time again, I'm the only member of Black Flag that counts. The other guys are tarnishing the legacy of Black Flag. And Greg Ginn has undermined completely both of those two arguments. A, the only person tarnishing Black Flag's legacy is Greg Ginn because how bad it is and how stupid and how none of the guys are really Black Flag except for Greg Ginn. But also, his new stuff shows that it really wasn't just Greg Ginn writing the music. Especially when you compare it to Off, especially when you compare it to Newer Descendants, especially when you compare it to, you know, even like Descadena's stuff. It just goes to show that for years and years and years, everyone's like, you know, Greg Ginn, he actually wrote all the stuff. He's the real force. The only person that has proved that it wasn't Greg Ginn was Greg Ginn. And so this is what he gets. And I'm still going to go see it, but I'm not going to enjoy it.
Where are you going to see it?
He's playing in the middle of Nowheresville, Pennsylvania. He's playing in Reading. Which is, I mean, that's not Nowheresville.
Right, I've heard of it.
Yeah, it's not Philadelphia. You know, like why would you not play Philadelphia? He's got this sick thing to like punish himself where like he plays like obscure areas instead of the big towns.
Well, I know when he played Michigan last time. He's playing Detroit this time, but last time they played Lansing. Talk about Lansing is no Grand Rapids. I mean, Grand Rapids has a couple hundred thousand people. At least Lansing is small. It's like 100,000 maybe.
He's got this weird fixation where,
but they don't draw, John. I don't think the big clubs, you know. He's not they don't draw well.
They drew in Philadelphia the first time I played in Philadelphia.
It's a curiosity thing for me, and that's why I did go see him. And like I said, when they were playing Black Flag, those songs, I thought they did pretty well. But there was too much of the sort of psychedelic type jamming, and I didn't even think Valeri was that bad as a front man. I know you liked him less than I did, but the truth is, when this is all said and done, Valeri is going to be the longest running Black Flag frontman. I mean, he's never going to replace Rollins and Keith Morris in the hearts and minds of the fans, but he's going to be the, by sheer years, he's going to be the guy. You watch.
But Skip McSkip has been the Dead Kennedys longer than Jell-O, but no one thinks of Skip McSkip as being the Dead Kennedys.
Yeah, it's true. But we kind of discussed this last week too, last week or 2 weeks ago, you know, Adam brought it up and he was absolutely right that the casual fan, when you look at this stuff and you see, oh, the Black Flag Tour, and you see someone ask, hey, is Rollins singing? And most of them aren't being ironic. They just have no idea.
Yeah, well.
I mean, they'll get there. Well, the question is, when they get there, will they realize it's not Rollins singing? That's the real question.
Yeah, because Valeri like makes himself look like a younger Rollins, you know.
Well, he's got longer hair.
No, circa 84. He dresses exactly the same as Rollins did in 84.
He should just dress the way Rollins did in the early 90s, just or the later, just straight black shorts, and that's it. Just like Nutter shorts.
Oh, those adorable little shorts.
That barely cover your sack, and that's it.
I need to breathe on stage.
No shoes, no shirt, no service. That's all I'm wearing right now. Tiny black shorts.
John, while you're going to go see the Greg Ginn Black Flag and not enjoy yourself, this is ample evidence why you need to get into like magic mushrooms or something like that, because then you can just go and have like a whole experience.
What does it cost to see Scab Black Flag in Reading, John? Like 15?
No, it's like 25 or 30.
Ooh. Yeah, I guess that's what it was, Lance. Probably like $25.
So anyways, I mean, there are fewer and fewer defenders. There's still some defenders out there, but I mean, talking about just destroying your own legacy, Flag paid it right the whole way. You know, luckily for Flag, Greg Ginn did raise a stink, and then that really worked in their benefit. He should
form a supergroup with like Jerry only once Danzig stops doing the Misfits again. It could be like just all the high profile guys who tried to ruin the legacy of a great band.
The Ruiners. Here's something that was unexpected that a lot of people were excited about, and I'm going to mention – actually, I'll just mention the interesting tidbit right now. Sheena Azella of Lemuria and Anika Pyle of Chumped and Augusta Koch of Kayetana have formed a new band. The band is called Sheena, Anika, and Augusta, and they're going to put out a new 4-song EP on Asian Man Records later on this year. I think we can all guess what it's going to kind of sound like. They all have sort of a similar kind of vibe, like an alt-rock kind of vibe, and I think they're all cool. I think Kayetana is real cool. Chumped and Lemuria is cool. Two things that really caught a lot of flack for their name, and honestly, I'm just gonna say it. If it was like Steve, Bill, and Jim, I don't think they would have caught any flack. You know what I mean? But also, what's interesting is the usual trolls, the nastiest trolls, the trolls that are the meanest and, you know, kind of grossest on the website, they're all like, this is a stupid name, but I love this band. And I do find it so – and this is not an uncommon scenario or an uncommon phenomenon, in that the nastiest trolls love music that is – I mean, the point of Chumped – I mean, the point of Kayetana, the point of Lemuria is that you should be a nice person and not be a dick. And meanwhile, the biggest dicks on the site love that kind of music. And I don't know why that is. And I'm like, who are you it's clear that like it's the message of all three of these bands is don't be a creepy, toxic guy. That's the message of all of these bands, right? And the people that love them the most, at least on our site, are creepy, toxic guys. How do you explain that?
No,
I choose not to explain it. I delve not into the psychology.
I'm at this point in the evening, I just couldn't even imagine.
John, I like letting you just grapple with these people, and I just float on by these
giant existential questions that you want to pose to us.
I don't want to legitimize these trolls, but I would like to see who they are in real life, and I have met two trolls in real life, and they are exactly who I thought they would be. You know what I mean?
I always love, you know, John, like we do our year end list, you know, and somebody will come on there, man, this list is really bad. And then they'll put their own on there, or either that, or they won't even dare do that. It's like, what are you listening to, dude? Tell me what you're listening to. You think what I'm listening to is so bad. And they're listening to freaking Manzingers or something, you know?
I hear you. So anyways, I am fascinated by the trolls, and I really should give them zero thought in my brain. And that's a falling on my part. I need to devote my brain to the destruction of Woodstock and the destruction of Black.
John, Black. later on, maybe even later on this very show, maybe we'll discuss a weapon that would be perfect for destroying the trolls.
Maybe we will. Someone plays.
Maybe we will. Maybe we won't.
So someone plays song in the meantime.
Go ahead, Adam.
All right. So, I keep running into these bands where I very much enjoy their records, and then when the genre of the band gets explained to me, it's always like slacker punk or slacker rock. And I'm never quite sure what that means in an actual like genre of music context, except that like they're a punk band, but they're not trying to be particularly, you know, Boots and Braces punk, but neither are they trying to be whatever, like whatever the kind of current melodic Beardo punk is. And there's some vague Pavement floating around in there. I'm not quite sure how you really understand what that is as a genre, but in any case, one of the bands that has that genre label is a band out of Vancouver called Dumb, and they released a record last year on Mint, and they have one coming out this year that they recorded like in the just over the winter themselves. And the record they had come out last year, which was cool, it's called Seeing Green. The one they have coming out now is called Club Nights, and every song I've heard from Club Nights has been super fun and I've been super into. So this record's coming out on June 7th. It's 14 songs. Again, completely self-produced by the band. They recorded it in January or February. They got Mikey Young from the Eddy Current Suppression Ring and Total Control to go in and do a master on it. So anyway, so this is the title track from Dumb's upcoming record. It is called Club Nights. It has my absolute favorite use of the word buddy in a song ever. So there you go.
Canadian music, more flavor to your ear. We got a couple of last stories here. We're running a little late. You guys want to hit this first story or skip it?
If I had the doc open, it would help.
If I can quote George Clinton, we'll hit it and then quit it. So anyways, Charter Daily has put out a new infographic, and basically it shows what we've all known all along. The height of the music industry was 1999, and that was the same year that Napster hit, and since then there's been a decline in music until 2015. In 2015, music sales started going back up. The majority of these music sales were for streaming. Meanwhile, downloads have been declining since 2015. Vinyl has been going up since 2015. However, even though we all talk about vinyl all the time, vinyl sales are negligible or nearly negligible when it comes to discussing music sales, and it's like 5% of music sales, which I find to be interesting, because whenever like a major label is trying to like make an act seem cool or hip, they'll push the vinyl record. You know, like if they go on Late Night with Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Kimmel will hold up the record, you know, or even if you go into like certain stores, there's the record. But the only people buying them, I guess, are obsessives. And so I found that interesting. Despite that, music sales are maybe 1/4 of what they used to be 30 years ago, which is a shame. And not only that, is when music sales used to go to record companies and artists directly more so than ever before, music income goes to streaming services. Income going to artists and even record company is about 1/30th, 1/20th of what it was in the 80s. So a lot of people blame the record industry themselves. Like, well, you should have been charging $20 for a CD. I don't blame the music industry. I mean, $20 for a CD is high, and true, CDs were $20 like 1996 1997, but if you went to the right shops, you can get it cheaper than that. Just at certain shops, they were like $20.
Yes.
But I think what it is people, as much more moralizing as people do on the internet, the fact is if someone can get something for free, they'll get it for free even at the cost of others. And that's the exact scenario we have here. People can get music for free and they say, oh, I wish artists could get more money, but I'm still going to stream stuff nonstop. And I think that's the real reason.
I think this is the other reason why shows are so getting to be so expensive, because they have to get more money to make a living now.
I got to disagree. I mean, I guess mainstream or club or theater level shows are much more expensive. True. Punk shows are cheaper than they've ever
been. Oh, yeah. They're still like $5. Yeah.
They're the same price they were in the 80s and 90s.
No. They're the same price they were when I first started going 30 years ago. $5.
That's so insane.
It is. It's crazy. But punks are good at undervaluing what they do. And I mean, I'm guilty of that myself. Pretty much everybody who works for Punk News is guilty, undervaluing what we do.
There's some interesting things about this infographic if you want to go look at it, listener, because there is what fascinates me is the 2005 to 2010 slight bubble of the music world that was ringtones, and that they decided to actually include that as part of this discussion. Because I understand having this discussion from a delivery format of music standpoint, right? So, you know, there is an interesting drop in the percentage that is downloads at the same point where streaming starts to grow. And you can absolutely, you know, think back and see that from, you remember when like the 99-cent song on iTunes was a big deal, or when companies like I was one of these people that had an e-music subscription where, you know, we used to go and you'd get like 30 downloads a month from these indie bands or something like that. Where nowadays, like, yeah, I guess Bandcamp has some of the download market there, but everything is being pushed out to Spotify and to Apple Music and all that. So you can see the split between download and streaming. That's interesting. You can see the comeback of vinyl. That's interesting. And then it's interesting in what a relatively small percentage it is, although really it's creeping up to like 50% of CD, at least in the most at the extreme end of this list, which is interesting.
That's true.
Find that.
But that ringtones is not only included, but is included as a delivery format of music that is worth considering as such, I think is arguable. Now, there's absolutely a cultural time in which ringtones mattered to anyone. And I don't know about you guys, but like, I haven't had my phone hasn't rang in 5 years at this point. Like it, if anyone calls it, it buzzes. I cannot think of, or if I don't have it on vibrate and it rings, it's just like, it's whatever the ringer on the phone is. I haven't really thought too much about, you know, going in there and tweaking it and making sure it's, you know, the first verse of Jungle Boogie or something like that. Like, but people used to do that. And but that's gone. And I think, so it's hilarious to think about that there was a time where like people, where that really mattered to people. And it factored into, you know, it factored into TV shows. It was always a comedy beat whenever you were watching like an early 2000s comedy. Like, someone would always have like an inappropriate, hilarious ringtone that would crop up at some point. But is that actually considered music sales from this standpoint?
It's only like 30 seconds tops. Yeah.
Well, like, yeah. So like, to me, that's just like a that's just like a weird gimmick. Like, I get that a band would get paid. So if, you know, if you're going to go and buy a chunk of an adolescent song to be your ringtone, like, I get that, you know, you got to give some money to Steve Soto or whatever, but I don't understand how that is the equivalent of a download album, or a stream or a record or a tape or something like that. That's just strange. I disagree about including that as a format, because I don't think anyone actually, I don't feel like that was a format that ever had a cultural reciprocal impact on the music, right? Like, you see music change based on the medium to some degree, right? When all we had was, you know, a 78 or a 45, you'd be recording sides of music that fit that, right? But, you know, you'd be making sure that your 2.5 minute pop song is going to fit on one half of that single someone's going to go buy. When all of a sudden, you know, there's 33s out there, you have all this album rock starts to come in. All of a sudden, CDs blow everything out of the water, because you could put, you know, fucking 78 minutes of music on the side of a, or on the side, on a continuous piece of media. And then with downloads, you see all of a sudden this resurgence of streaming and a de-emphasis of the album. But did ringtones ever affect shit? Like, did you know, were bands recording 30-second songs? Was short music for short people recorded in advance of the ringtone economy? I don't get it.
It affected me, Adam, because I had Blitzkrieg Bop as my ring on my old phone. And, you know, I have a job where I occasionally get called and woke up in the middle of the night. And I was getting a phone call in the middle of the night, and I was dreaming that I was at a Ramones show. And then I was very disappointed when I had to get up and go to work. But it's funny, my new phone, I don't. Yeah, you're right. You guys were making fun of my ring the other day, but the old man ring. I have the ring that I think is most likely to wake me up.
Well, see, I was always, I never got the ringtone thing, partly because I've, for the last, 15 years of my life, like, I've technically been on call. Like I work in a small company, and if something stops working, they're going to call me and I have to go fix it. And if it stops working in the middle of the night, and this doesn't happen, knock on wood, all that often, you know, I'm one of the few people that's going to be able to go and deal with that. So there was a time where, and then there was a time too, before we had more employees, where I was on call for like every little thing that a client could possibly need after hours. So, you know, my phone all of a sudden ringing was something that I dreaded. It was not a thing that I welcomed. And the idea of taking London calling and making that the harbinger of sadness for me.
Okay, you don't have to do that, but you could, like my wife has custom ringtones, I know, and I can't remember what mine is, but like each kid has a different ringtone. And I have a different ringtone. You could, like, you know, when your wife called you, Marvin Gaye could start singing "Let's Get It On" or something. I mean, that would be all right, right? Be like Pavlov's Dog.
No, do people? Well, you just said your wife still does that. Like people do that still.
Yeah, she. Yeah, people still. And my, I know my boss has his. I can't remember. He's got all different ringtones, for one for his wife, one for business stuff. Yeah, no, people still do.
Do you live
it.
In like a?
I just haven't.
In like,
I mean,
a cultural anachronism society or something.
I liked it. I liked it when I had it, but I just hadn't gone. Like I said, I got a new phone. I didn't go through the trouble.
Well, speaking of frivolous spending, Gucci has hired somewhat unusual models to be part of their, it's called the pre-fall campaign. Amel and the Sniffers and Surfboard are the new models for Gucci, which, as we've said before, we've seen this phenomenon somewhat before in an extremely high-end fashion brand. And honestly, I don't know if is Gucci extremely high-end or pseudo-high-end or just regular high-end. You guys know, because I wouldn't spend $300 on a belt. But I mean, is that pseudo-high fashion, high fashion, or super high fashion?
I don't fucking know.
I think it's high fashion. I mean, I don't think it's like what billionaires wear, but I think it's what like rich people wear.
See, is it or is it what people who aren't rich who want to appear rich wear? You know,
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how much money I have. I'm still going to wear Dickies and Levi's, so it really doesn't matter.
Well, fair enough. So, anyways, remember we used to see this thing where like expensive companies would like sell a black flag shirt for $350, or they take a leather jacket and put Against Me on it and sell it for like $600 or $800 or more even. Now we've got a high end fashion company getting two extremely buzzy, up and rising punk bands to be their new models. Of course, Amo and the Sniffers haven't even put out an album yet. They're extremely buzzy, and Surfboard are fairly buzzy too. And they just put out their first album. And is this just an interesting thing, or is this a trend, or are they? I mean, punks aren't buying this stuff, you know. But we go back to that question that we had before. Punks aren't buying this, but are people that will spend, say, $1,100 on a shirt, will they buy it because they think punk is cool, even though they're not involved in the punk culture, and they kind of think that makes it edgy? I don't know.
Well, there's two elements to it. One is that, you know, years past, we would have totally begrudged a band doing this. But now, as we just discussed, the record business is so bad. You really, like, this is totally selling out, but we don't even begrudge a band anymore, right?
Yeah, but you can't. I mean, listen, no one's making any money.
No, I know.
Even a buzz band like Aim on the Sniffers, they're not making that much money. They really not.
The other element of it is, you know, everybody wants to appear grassroots, even if there's big money behind it. You know, a band like the Aim on the Sniffers, they might have big money behind them. We don't know. You're talking about how they might have like a shadowy kind of major label behind them, but they're doing that secretly so that it can appear organic, you know? Like, we see that with political movements all the time. Oh, it's a grassroots movement until you find out there's a billionaire, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it happens on both sides of the political spectrum. So it's you know, it's a credibility thing, you know. They're trying to – Gucci's trying to get some street cred, and these poor bands are just trying to make a buck.
But here's a question that I have is people that buy Gucci aren't into punk rock. Like, if you see people that wear Gucci, they're not punk rock people, you know. So why are punk rock people being applied to the Gucci brand, if you will?
Maybe to make it edgier? Yeah, I don't know.
Adam, these clothes, are they really ugly or exceptionally ugly?
Hold on, I will judge this. Let me raise a picture. Here it is.
Is there a picture?
Yeah.
There's two pictures. I mean, I could buy this. I feel like I'm not trying to be like Mr. Like, oh, high fashion is stupid, because sometimes high fashion – actually, I don't think high fashion ever looks like as good as expensive. But I could make these outfits at the thrift store. I really could.
Yikes.
You talking like this gold LeMay thing?
I don't know what LeMay is, honestly. Which photo are you looking at? Oh, no, that's the article picture. Scroll down. I mean, that's from the magazine.
That's like their band photo.
That's a Gucci photo. They're wearing Gucci clothes in that.
In the gold, the first picture in the article where they have the tongues hanging out?
Yeah, that's actually the Gucci magazine.
Okay, so that gold LeMay I was talking about was like old ladies are used to only wear that. It was like this gold fabric.
That's true.
And then the next one, they look like some kind of freaking Peter Pan rejects or something.
That's what I'm saying.
You know, and the last one, if they showed up at my front door, I would greet them with a shotgun. The mask and the weird, like, the pasty ginger and, like, the weird Hawkman looking in, like, the 60s throwback thing. The one on the far right looks like the guitar player from the Rolling Stones that died in the swimming pool. It's not for me.
But it's not for you, Tom, mind you. It's not for you.
No, I don't own a $300 item of clothing.
I don't understand. I don't understand this at all. So the first of the two images, and listener, I'm listening to us talk about images that we're looking at. I'm sure it's really great podcasting to you, but you should probably go look up this article on Punk News so you can follow along.
What is the guy in the hawk mask holding? Is it like a weird doll or something?
I think it's a thick boa.
No, there's the fashion accessory we all didn't know we need. A thick boa.
So much of the stuff that they're wearing looks like, yeah, like part of a stage production, like costume stuff.
It's very androgynous.
Yeah, but it's not cool androgynous. It's sort of like you're in a Disney on Ice production androgynous. That's what I don't get.
The bottom?
I don't get the picture on the bottom, at least, like, are somewhat normal clothes.
But the guy second from the right on the bottom, I mean, he's I think it's a man, but he kind of looks like Grace Jones from Grace Jones.
He's the coolest looking one in the whole thing to me.
I mean, it's fine. Listen, it's fine. I mean, apparently it must work, right? We're not in a good position to judge.
Well, I just don't understand where like in the normal course of your day, you would wear like 95% of this, and therefore I don't think it's real. I'm convinced that most of the stuff that exists within the realm of fashion exists for the spectacle of it. It's like when you see people like doing like runway fashion and stuff, and they're wearing like these bizarre outfits where you would never see anyone walking down the street in that.
Like, but bird feathers.
It's all wrapped up in, you know, who that model is and who that designer is and, you know, what kind of artistry is involved and all this and that. And I don't want to claim that I'm too good for fashion artistry, because I don't know anything about it. I'm willing to accept that there is something going on there that is worthy of artistic discussion, and that I just don't understand it any more than I understand, you know, sculpture or something like that. Like, I don't know anything about.
But what you're talking about, Adam, like the runway stuff with the real weird, crazy outfits and that, isn't that like the equivalent of like when you go to an auto show and they have like these weird concept cars that are never going to get made?
Yeah, you know, yeah, I mean, exactly.
It's kind of like to show off, but it's not. I mean, I assume the rest of these clothes, they're trying to, I mean, who's wearing that Peter Pan outfit?
Well, no one. That's the thing. I think that these
stuff,
are. Right?
But I assume they're trying to sell this stuff. Well, then why are they laying out all this money?
No. What they're going to do is that they're going to dress them up in all of this bizarre Peter Pan stuff. And then what they're actually going to sell is, you know, a black handbag with the Gucci logo stitched on the side of it by a sweatshop kid. And then that's the thing that you're actually going to be able to go buy at your local store, and people will buy it because it says Gucci. Like, it's just part of this whole like weird branding thing.
Tell me out.
Adam, I think you're exactly correct on that. Do you guys know how much we've actually seen a couple of bands that had this happen before. Do you know how much money they get paid for doing these kinds of things?
No, why? What?
A lot, like more than you think, like a lot. I know another band,
thousands.
Yeah, like I know another band that did this exact thing. The amount of money they got just for like literally walking up and down the runway like five times, like you're like, whoa, like way more than you think they'd get.
But that's also why I can't fault it. Where I'm like, no one's buying your records. No one's coming to your shows. You have to live in a van and eat garbage. And if you don't live in a van and eat garbage, then people on the internet will yell at you. So you know what? Dress up like Peter Pan and get paid tens of thousands of dollars. That's great. I'm all for it.
I'd probably do it. I'll admit it.
Well, speaking of eating garbage and trying to retain your youthfulness, even though you're entering 40s and 50s, Blink-182 has gone on tour with Lil Wayne. They even released a collaborative song together. It was a mashup of What's My Age and a Millie, which is the respective biggest hits. Daring choice, marketing move, or old men desperately holding on to their fastly fading youth.
I don't know.
I care less about this than Gucci clothes. I got to tell you, this is so. I don't know what they're trying to do here. What is the crossover audience for Lil Wayne and Blink-182? This is insanity. Do you really?
Yeah, frat bros.
So you're just saying Blink-182 is officially just a pop band at this point.
At this point, tried since like 1993.
Man, I am not going to this. There's zero chance. It was like we were talking about the Woodstock thing earlier, and what I wanted to ask you guys was if it was convenient and you didn't have to pay, would you go to that Woodstock? Because to me, the answer honestly would have been no. I wouldn't have gone for free.
I'd go because Robert Plant is playing.
But he'll do some theaters around that date. But anyway.
Can I go to this for free?
No, you'll pay for that. But it's the same thing with this. I mean, I wouldn't go to this for free.
No, I wouldn't.
I mean, I wouldn't do it. You know, I occasionally will kind of go to a show just for the sake of reviewing it, just for like with my kid or something, just, you know, for fun. But I wouldn't do this. I just wouldn't go to this. I mean, ugh, no thanks. I don't know which one. I don't know which one I'd like to see least.
Here's the thing: is like I'd want to see Blink less.
Oh, I don't know, man, I'm not a big Lil Wayne guy.
I'm not any sort of Lil Wayne guy. But just Blink has this problem that a lot of like really popular pop punk bands from I guess that era have had is that like. I don't think they can sing. Like, and not that I don't think they can sing from a like, oh, I don't like their voice standpoint. Like, I don't think they can carry the notes that they hit with the help of studio stuff. And I think Green Day can, like Billy Joe can, and so they're not part of this. But like, if you want to come back and circle everything back to Woodstock, watch the Offspring's set from Woodstock. Either 99 or 95 or 94 or 96 or whatever the fuck it happened, right? Whenever the Offspring played there, like Dexter could not do any of the of like the I think it was after Americana came out when they were on that. Like he cannot hit any of those notes at all. He can kind of hit the notes from like Smash because those were more punky grungy songs
actually like, recorded kind of like, yeah traditional
he,
albums
right and they're ones that he actually had to like sing in the studio and not just have Pro Tools fix it. But any of those new songs or new in the time, they're 20 fucking years old right now, but like and any of that other material, like he just couldn't do it live, and it was just embarrassing.
I would be so bummed out if I went and saw the Offspring and they couldn't properly pull off Pretty Fly for a White Guy.
Well, right,
that but would like, be very very disappointing.
Well, but not
you, dude, you
don't want to hear him wheezing
either. I don't know about that. I don't know if I agree with that about Blink-182, just because I did see him a couple years ago. And I thought they pulled it off fairly well. But I mean, here's the thing with like Mark, like, okay, so Matt is probably the Alkaline Trio guy is probably more talented than Tom DeLonge was, probably more talented than Matt, right? Or than the other dude.
Mark.
But the songs weren't Mark. Yeah, but Mark's songs weren't challenging to sing. It's not like he really had to show any range or anything. You know what I mean?
He still could
pull them off live.
I guess, but just going off this video, that was my major impression looking at this video.
They put out a couple of new songs and they are so bad. I mean, a couple of the California songs have kind of grown on me just because I've heard them enough times, but these new songs are bad, man. They are bad. They don't even, you know, the thing with punk in general, you know, it's like, of course, you had the Clash and the Ramones and the Pistols and all that and the Damned. And then the next generation maybe was a photocopy of that, right? And then the next generation was a photocopy of that. So every time you make a photocopy, at least back in the old days, not so much now because the photocopy is a lot better. But back in the old days, every time you made a photocopy, it was more faded than the one before. And I mean, let's face it, Blink-182 is at least one or two photocopies removed from freaking Green Day. Which how many generations is that removed? You know, so there ain't much. If punk is the black ink, there ain't much left. You know,
I love that. Nothing, you had to check honestly, yourself there to make sure that you didn't insult modern photocopier technology. But
well, that's true. New photocopiers are pretty damn good. You don't get that loss anymore.
No, I'm but showing like, my age. I know.
But you know what I'm saying, though.
No, I do.
Each generation loses something, and Blink-182 is so many generations removed. But the sad thing is, there's so many bands right now whose gateway to punk band was Blink-182 and their biggest influence is Blink-182. There's a ton of young bands
that sound. I don't disagree with this, but just coming back to this video though, like I watched this and
I didn't watch the video.
Oh, well, watch the video. That's what we're talking about. No, like I watched it and I saw
him live a couple years ago.
I was not annoyed with Lil Wayne at all. Like I was just kind of annoyed with, and this song is from my era of Blink-182. Enema of the State was the start and stop of my love affair with this band. It lasted like two or three months. before,
you know, it was hard to go much further than that, honestly.
Well, no, the but like, I was really respect. Into this record before, like, I was young and I was a teenager, and this was the kind of stuff that was, you know, it was blazing out of our K cars as we were fucking driving around, doing teenager shit, right? But that was, there was a few months before What's My Age Again blew up because of that video, and then it just became like oversaturation, and I tuned it out. What's My Age Again was like, you know, the, oh no, sorry, I botched that there. All the Small Things was the one that blew up. And then after that, it was this thing, I'm moving on from this. But What's My Age Again was like, that was one of my Blink songs, like between Damn It on the record previous and that, like, I was totally into this band, and I was watching this video, and all I could think was that, like, he sounds kind of anemic to me. Like there's some oomph that he needs to put in to get this vocal delivery right, and it's not there. It just kind of sounds. It's like
maybe he's not getting enough iron at him.
If you need more iron in your life, Integrity's got a solution for you. They're releasing an actual mace, like an actual mace that the kind of like barbarians and knights and Vikings would smash each over the head with. It's being released in conjunction with Wolf Brigade Gym, and they're releasing 18 maces total, 6 that are 8 kilograms, 6 that are 10 kilograms, and 6 that are 12 kilograms. That's like 24, like 26 pounds. That's a pretty heavy
mace. What weight do you go? You go in the middleweight gym?
I'm going middleweight. You going 10 kilograms, good 20 pounds, smash.
I agree. A nice balance of power and speed.
I mean, that's when you think about how heavy a 12-pound sledge is, like a 20-pound.
But it's kilogram, right? But it's 12 kilogram. I mean, it's not.
Right. 12 kilograms, which is like, what, 25, 26 pounds, something like that.
Oh, that's right. A kilogram. Oh, yeah. I was doing the math backwards in my head. Okay.
I mean, that's really like a 12-pound sledgehammer is like really heavy, you know? They're putting out 18 maces total. The reason they're putting them out is Wolf Brigade Gym. They've developed a new kind of like workout routine where you swing a mace around and pretend you're a Viking and smash stuff. Integrity, despite being a very serious band, at least lyrically and in their music, they have put out some silly merch items, including cups and koozies and beanies and that kind of a thing. And
that's just paying the rent, John. Just paying the rent.
And these aren't cheap; they're $350 each, mind you. You really gotta want this mace if you want it.
We should get those. I'm telling you, be like, take that, internet troll, smash. enjoy your face full of metal, frat boy, smash. Blink 182 fan, crash.
Do you think a $350 mace will be more damaging than say like a $30 sledgehammer?
I think it'll probably be more damaging than like the ninja weapons I used to order out of the back of catalogs in the 80s.
Adam, how many maces are you going to order, and who will you use them on?
And which weight?
I'm very conflicted about this. About this product. I'm kind of fascinated about it. It makes it
I didn't feel like the picture doesn't really do him justice. I really would need to.
Watch the video.
I really need to bury it into an enemy skull to really get a feel for a mace.
So. But this is the fact that this is part of what I can only assume is a soon to be fad workout is maybe less.
Soon to be fad? You think it's going to go viral, Adam? You think this is going to be huge? They're making 18 of these things.
The mace workout is going to be the new kettlebells or you know, it's going to be the new Pilates. It's going to be like a mace. It's going
to be the new Taibo.
Yeah. It is a ball welded to a rod with the band's logo spray painted to it, right? Like I'm not.
That's what it is.
I like the old school ones with the chain and the spiked ball.
That's a morning star, though. They got to make Integrity morning stars.
Don't give me any ideas.
I would buy an Integrity morning star. I buy any morning star. I never see morning stars. John,
350 Samoans. That's a lot, man.
Adam, have you gone to the Morningstar Depot recently?
I feel that, like, you know, if I go into a Walmart, I can get some bananas and I can get some underwear. I should be able to buy a Morningstar.
You can get a shotgun at Walmart.
Yeah, there you go. Shotgun beats mace from five paces.
You can get a shotgun at a Walmart?
I think so.
Fuck you, America. Jesus Christ.
Dude, there's no school shooting guns.
I think we all should get some Mace's boys and just go on a troll rampage and teach them a lesson. And also some competition. But when we come across some other like offending websites, we'll pay them a visit with our integrity Mace's.
John will steal your idea for the poster art and have our three faces on there, like menacingly holding our Mace's in a triangular figure. Or no, the Chimera, the three headed dog, all each paw holding a mace.
Ah, the three headed dog is Kerberos, the Chimera. Actually, the Chimera in actual Greek mythology is kind of stupid. It's a lion with a goat's head on its back and a snake's tail. And honestly, I don't know if a lion with a goat's head on its back is any more scary than just a regular lion. Because a regular lion can mess you up pretty bad. I don't know if the goat's head on the back makes it.
But if the lion somehow takes a swipe at you and misses, the goat can jab you with his razor sharp horns. And they can chew on like tin cans and stuff.
That's true. Which
could potentially come in handy in a battle situation.
You go to swing your mace and there's just been the big bite out of the side of it and it just crumples back and hits you in the face, and it's because of the goat. This is a weird episode.
It is a weird episode, and it's going to get weirder because, you know, I'm having this issue. I used to like keep track of what songs I played, but I used to only be on about once a month or so it wasn't that hard. But I've kind of gotten forgetful about what I'm playing, so I am going to. I think there's only one appropriate way to end this show, and that is by playing Woodstock by Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Well, I came upon a child of God. He was walking.
behind the cost of freedom buried in the ground. Mother Earth will swallow you, lay your body down. Find the cost of freedom buried in the ground. Mother Earth will swallow you, lay your body.
And that was Woodstock, man. Peace and love, or war and hate. That's what we're all about. You can always reach that podcast at punknews.org. Tom, as always, thanks for being on. Any last words, any last comments, or what you're going to do with your battle mace?
No, I'm gonna do some extensive training, John. Maybe this summer we can get together and have some sparring, you know, just some loose, friendly sparring. Of course, we'll use our foam maces, not our actual steel ones. But it'd be good to take on, you know, the other, you know, prominent punk websites at the annual mace battle.
Adam, like, will you be joining us during our mace training?
Yeah, sure. No, I'm in for it. We're gonna need it to fight off the copyright people because you just made us play CSNY.
I might bring a Morningstar just to mix it up a little bit.